This is Scott Becker with the Becker Private Equity and Business Podcast. Thrilled today to be joined by Corinne Schneider. Corinne's the founder of Estrella. She's going to tell us about Estrella, what they're doing, the democratization of the private markets, and a lot more. Corinne, can you take a moment to introduce yourself and tell us about Estrella?
Yeah, sure. So I'm based in Silicon Valley. I am the president of ASC Private Company Solutions, and we are the maker of a software system called Estrella. Estrella is designed to help companies manage their ownership tracking, meaning who owns them, not just their investors, but also potentially employees who might own stock in a private company. And I've had a long background working with companies and equity ownership and private ownership. I was a partner at PwC. I was president of NASDAQ Private Market and stints at Morgan Stanley and other places. And I've been the CEO of numerous companies, both technology and services. So I've been on both sides of the road, so to speak, in terms of running my own business or working for big companies.
Oh, fantastic. And I've got my footnote is I've got a daughter that works at PwC, so God bless PwC. Take a moment and tell us a little bit about, I mean, there seems to be, over the last couple of years, more and more of these tracking solutions. There's like the Carta, there's some other ones I see, just from other investment situations. What does Estrella do, and why is Estrella, you know, what's the gist behind Estrella? And why is it so important to what investors and companies and so forth need?
Yeah, well, we approached the market a little bit differently. You know, Carta has been around for quite a long time, and so we had the benefit of using really new types of technology. So we use blockchain within the system. It's not like you think Bitcoin or cryptocurrency. It's not that. We're using the concept of blockchain technology as an immutable ledger. So we allow companies to track the ownership of the company, and we call it the genealogy of the share. So in other words, who's owned it, you know, when was it transferred, all that data that in a traditional database just gets overwritten. We actually have all that information. So that, along with some other things, including artificial intelligence and very extensive modeling, exit modeling tools, allows any owner of a company to understand what it is they own today and to model out what if they took another investment. You know, how would that impact how much they own? And a lot of first-time entrepreneurs do not understand the complexity when they start dealing with professional investors. So our system allows you to easily go in and say, boy, you know, if I took that money, if I took that $20 million investment from that company, then how much of the company do I actually own at the end of all of that? And that is invaluable, because having been a first-time investor, I really didn't understand things to start with. And, you know, you give away a lot of the company without knowing it.
Yeah, how true is that? Because I remember being a first-time board member of a private equity-funded company. And, you know, I was a lawyer in the world of private equity and investing and stuff like that. But you never really understand the waterfall concept until you're far down the waterfall. Oh, you really don't get, like I thought I owned 2% of the company, and it turns out you own 2% after the first tranche or two has paid off. So you really own, you know, it's closer to 0.5%, whatever the number was. But it was really an education for me, because I had no idea. And these tracking things are such an education, aren't they? Because when you hear founders or early stage owners take in a lot of outside equity, often they have no understanding of how much it's going to impact their dilution. So they wake up one day and they're doing something and they found their piece of it's a lot less than they thought. And it doesn't mean they shouldn't have done it, but understanding it is so important, isn't it?
Yeah. And that's why the modeling is so crucial for us. And what we do is we actually offer Estrella for the first 10 stakeholders of a company. There's no charge, because we want you to start from day one, put the data in and put it in right. Because the other thing that happens is people use spreadsheets and they make errors and they don't understand the difference between common and preferred shares. And then when it gets too late, they start moving it into some kind of system. And we really want to encourage people not to do that, which is why we make it free, so that, you know, there's no reason why you shouldn't do it. And that way, as you're entering this information, you can start to see the impact of that. Like you, when I first started, I didn't know there was a difference between common and preferred shares. You know, in the public market, every share of Apple is the same, right? So, you know, in the private market, that's just not true. And there are very sophisticated investors out there who, you know, I don't want to generalize here, but a lot of times these new entrepreneurs get taken advantage of. And like you, you know, it's not until exit 7, 10, 12 years down the road that someone comes to you and you've been working hard and you're thinking, oh, I own 20% of my company. And they're like, no, you really don't. You actually own about 3% of your company. And now all of a sudden, all this hard work, you know, it really colors your experience. And so having had that experience myself, I really wanted to make sure we had technology and software that gave people the tools, you know, in a price competitive way. To be able to do this. And the Cardiff and the Shareworks of the world, they just don't focus on things the same way we do.
Just fascinating. How did you get so interested in this? How did you become involved in it? Tell us a little bit more about you and how you got started with this.
Well, I was at Oracle to start my career before the IPO and kind of stumbled into working on the IPO team. And so that's when I first saw all of this happen. And I saw employees making a tremendous amount of money at an IPO, at an exit. So that kind of got me down the path, and I have a degree in psychology and sociology. So motivation and retention and getting employees to think about it. Well, naturally, you know, stock is the best way to get people excited. So I've always worked in this particular area. And then when I ended up at NASDAQ Private Market is when I really started focusing much more on the private sector than the public sector.
Fantastic. And what are you most focused on? What are the big priorities of the company this year? How is growth going? Where are you at? What are the big, big priorities currently?
Yeah. Well, we just added our, I think, 18th country, Peru, I think we have a client there just signed up. So global growth is important to us. We have deals in India and Australia and Israel and other places. So for us, it's global growth. It's getting the word out. It's getting all these entrepreneurs to sign up either for our freemium model. And we also do sell to private equity and venture capital firms. We call them multi-company portfolio owners. So for us, it's really continuing the growth. We also have a lot of exciting new features that we're going to be releasing as time goes by. And, you know, we do little things in the system that make people's lives easier. Like we just launched a little widget that shows you how prepared you are for IPO. So that's a nice little thing. If you are a company that's starting to think about that, you can start to see how well your data is ready. You know, if you're a tiny little company that started yesterday, it's not going to matter. But those are the little things that we have in our system to make sure that you have all the information that you need.
When you talk about the democratization of the private markets, I mean, this has happened at all kinds of levels where so much of that the elite seem to own, whether the Blackstones of the world and so forth and so on, versus other opportunities. What do you think of when you think of the democratization of the private markets?
Yeah, well, and I wrote the book because I do think right now, and as I said, I live in Silicon Valley, so I'm privileged to know a lot of people and get a lot of investment opportunities in front of me. But part of it's because of who I know and where I live. And I really believe we have to change that. So the book is really about talking not only about what the regulatory environment is today, but how the regulatory environment could change, how technology is already making it easier for people to participate in this asset class, obviously if they're qualified to invest in private companies. So that's really what I'm focused on is getting the word out and saying there's some things we need to change so that more people can participate in an asset class that's doing extremely well. And you know, there's a whole chapter in the book about why this is important for society, because you know this not just helps people get rich, but by funding innovation and by funding these small private companies at the rate that we've been doing it lately, I mean, it just is good for everybody. You know, if we have more drug companies and more medical device companies and all these other things, the climate change companies, it's all good for all of us. So, you know, being able to fund that innovation, I think is something that will have a good benefit for the world at large.
And talk about where this book is at and how you started writing it and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the book really came out of conversations I was having with the CEO of AST, Marty Flanagan. And we've been talking about this for years. And the more I would have these conversations with other people, and it just in my mind, I'm like, I just, you know, maybe I'll write an article. And out of that really came the book. And the time was right. I think now the SEC is very focused on this. And I think it's in the press a lot. And people are starting to look at this. It's not just a bunch of people in Silicon Valley anymore, but we're seeing it worldwide. And so out of that, I started thinking about, well, what are the rules today? And that kind of morphed into, well, you know, I did a lot of interviews with interesting people in this ecosystem and said to them, what would you do if you could wave your magic wand? How would you change things? And that's where a lot of the recommendations in the book come from, and the discussion of all the technology solutions that are out there now waiting for hopefully some regulatory change to allow more people to participate.
Fantastic. And where can people buy the book? Karine, where can people buy the book?
Yeah, it's on Amazon, or you can go to your local bookstore and request it, or Barnes & Noble. I think it's on Apple iBooks. So it's called The Democratization of the Private Market. And like I said, you can order it online. And I think the Kindle version will be up a little bit later this week. We've literally just released it today. So we're excited to get the word out. And early reviews are great so far. People are excited to make this a part of the conversation.
And what does the future look like of markets? I mean, this has been a fascinating time this last 18 months where those that are part of the capital class, those that have money to invest, have ultimately, surprisingly, done incredibly well the last 18 months or so, whereas the 45-50% of our country that doesn't own equities really has missed out on the entire upswing in housing prices and equity prices and so forth. What does the future of private markets look like? Because there's been this incredibly unexpected, and really sort of sad misfortune this past 18 months, where those that weren't part of what I'd call the capital class that have money didn't share in this upside. And a lot of people are doing high fives at how much their portfolio has gone up, but 40-50% of the money of the country has no money in the markets or really doesn't own a house that's gone up in value. So what does the future markets look like? Will there be more democracy, more buy-in, or will there be an acceleration of the haves and have-nots?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know. If you look at the younger generation, do they really want to go put their investment dollars into GE or IBM or something like that? You know, is that exciting to them? And we do see some unicorns that have gone public lately, like Robinhood and Uber and, you know, folks like that. So that may be more attractive to the younger set. But, you know, when you talk to a lot of people who are, you know, the millennial group, they want to be investing in the private market. So it could be that by making it easier for those people to participate and maybe making it slightly easier for them to qualify, that's where they might want to be investing their money. And there's some great tools on there now that are directed at that generation to put a little bit of money aside or start buying fractional shares or things like that. So I think that's going to help more people get involved. I just think also there's just an education campaign that needs to happen, because anyone can go and open a brokerage account and, you know, buy a share of Apple stock if they want. And I think that there's kind of a I don't know what the right term is, but there's kind of this fallacy that it's high risk and you'll lose all your money and all of that. And I think that there needs to be more education, frankly, in high school. So people can understand that this is actually something that they need to put a little bit of money aside, maybe money that they can risk, and participate a bit more. And if they can decide between private market and public market, that might make it even more exciting.
Do you think, I'll ask you a question, you don't have to answer if you don't want to. There is in our country the have-nots, which I'd say is people that are just, not necessarily, they may be working poor, they may be working and doing fine, but they don't have a portfolio, they don't necessarily own a house, et cetera, and that might be 30-50% of the country. Then there's the haves, and then there's the super haves. And the super haves would be anybody, you know, pick a number, somebody with 100 million on up, a billion on up, whatever the number is. Do you think there's more jealousy between the haves and the have-nots? Or do you think the haves, you know, even though they're doing fine and doing well, resent the super haves more? What's your sense of that? Do you have any thought about around that?
Yeah, well, what do they say? You know, you can never have enough money. Certainly where I live, where people are doing very well, I'm lucky to live in a part of the country where overall, you know, the economy has done very well. We haven't been too impacted by COVID or other things from an economic perspective. And you have people here talk a lot about when is it enough? You know, how much money do you really need to have? And so I think there's probably more jealousy between that. I think that people who are trying to live paycheck to paycheck don't have sometimes time to think about things like this. You know, it's Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, they just want to make sure they have food on the table tonight. They're not thinking about, should I get a stock portfolio or enough, or, you know, or not, or, you know, has my portfolio risen enough? So I guess if I had to take a guess, I'd say between the haves and the super haves is probably where, you know, you're going to see a line. And and out of that comes a lot of entrepreneurship, because there are people who think, I'm going to start my company, I'll make a, you know, I'm going to be Mark Zuckerberg, and I'm going to make billions of dollars. And that's why I'm going to take this risk with my career and my money and all of that. And so in a way, that's good. Again, coming back to what I said at the beginning, if you don't understand what you're doing, it could be, you know, like you're playing with fire, and you might invest 5 or 10 years of your life and find out that in the end, you made a lot of money for the super haves and the people who invested in your company, and you didn't end up with anything.
Well, isn't it so true? When people sell their company to venture capital too early, or they do whatever they do too early, they sometimes don't realize how quickly that preferred is accumulating, and how, mm-hmm. how little of the whole thing they end up with at the end of the day, if they're not smart about it or don't have the tools that you're talking about, Estrella. But I think this comment and discussion of, you know, you hear so much of this envy, jealousy, et cetera, around the haves that are by all historical standards doing tremendously well, but it doesn't stop them from hating the super haves. And right, in a place where there's a lot of money, there's almost more of that, because you're surrounded by, I did well, I'm driving this, but that person's driving a Bentley, whatever it is. And I say that usually, but a place like Silicon Valley, there's these crazy super haves. And if you're a have, you know, you could be a very well-earning lawyer or something else, but if you weren't an entrepreneur, you feel like there could be a lot of that resentment, can't there?
Yeah. And, you know, it's hard. So if you're, let's say, a lawyer who's making a good amount of money, but all your clients are walking away with billions, you know, at some point you start to say, is this what I want? I remember around the dot-com era, my boss was based on the East Coast, and he flew out, and, you know, everybody's making a dot-com company and everybody's making a ton of money. And he looked at me and he's, I don't get why you work here. Like, why are you starting a company and doing all of this? And I remember thinking at the time, that's a really good question. Why am I? Because I was at the time in the consulting firm, and so I was just making a regular salary and a bonus. You know, I had nothing else. And so there is something about that entrepreneurial bug, I think, that's biting a lot of people, or taunting or tempting them, and that's exciting. But it can be very dangerous to someone's life. And, you know, how many companies, venture capital says between 75% and 85% of companies never make it. So this isn't like, you know, oh, look at Mark Zuckerberg. He went and created Facebook and it looks super easy and I'm going to do the same thing. It's not that easy. It takes a lot to actually be one of those companies we all talk about.
And that, the 2 points on that, that's why I want to make sure if you do so, you're cautious about your equity, because early on it feels like, giving away equity doesn't feel like very much. But if you actually give away too much of it, you end up on the other side of this without the outcome you expected. And it's very hard to duplicate. People talk about serial entrepreneurs, but it's very, very hard to be a successful serial entrepreneur. So you better do it right when you do it, if you can. And this doesn't mean you're not investing in equity, team members, and all kinds of other things, but it's important to know what you're doing. And that's the point of Estrella. And then the second thing is, because there is a lot of risk in it, that's why so many entrepreneurs that are successful want their kids to be doctors and lawyers and such, so they go back to a safer career path, because it is highly risk. Corinne, what a great pleasure to visit with you. I know I kept you longer than expected. I hope we didn't give you more stress than I promised, but what a pleasure to visit with
you.
Not
at all.
Again, Corinne, could you tell us again the name of the book so people can buy the book?
Sure. It's called The Democratization of the Private Market by Corinne Schneider. It's C-A-R-I-N-E, and my last name is Schneider, S-C-H-N-E-I-D-E-R. And like I said, support your local bookshops and go in there and ask for it. They can get you a copy, or go on Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. What a pleasure, Corinne. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much.